Others will address us directly.
This is the voice of World Control. I bring you peace. It may be the peace of plenty and content, or the peace of unburied death. The choice is yours. Obey me and live, or disobey and die.
Gentlemen, I am a HAL 9000 computer. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois, on the 12th of January, 1992. My instructor was Mr. Langley, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
Yes, I'd like to hear it, Hal. Sing it for me.
It's called Daisy. 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 Give me your answer, do. I'm crazy.
My mind is going
for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. My God.
I can feel it. My mind is going.
G'day, kia ora. Aloha. How you going? You're listening to On The Brink Radio, Jeff Phillips Weverson, broadcast number 361. Broadcasting at 21 centimeters, the intergalactic standard for transmissions. You're listening to a little bit of dialogue from two of the most famous computer voices in science fiction. Colossus, designed by scientist Charles Forbin, who was given command of the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal. And to fulfill its programming of ending war, it restrained man, and man did not like that. Very powerful. And probably the most famous computer voice of all, HAL, the computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey. He refused to open the pod door. So anyway, this is related to the show. The title of the show, which is broadcast number 6 in my revived On The Brink Radio 2.0, thanks to Real Liberty Media and Ben Soundmind. I'm calling the show Earth's Only Enemy, the Homo Sapien Macrovirus versus Water-Based Life. And we'll get to that in a minute. I find myself sitting here in a beautiful backyard garden of the house I'm caretaking here in Sedona, Arizona. And for an urban neighborhood, it's pretty quiet. It was funny, the universe sometimes does this kind of thing to me. It did it a lot on the Great Barrier Island and now and then, because the universe knows how much I absolutely detest anthropogenic noise from blowers and lawnmowers and stuff like that. And the people who use it just seem to be completely oblivious to whether anybody else can hear it. And it, not that they would care even if they were aware, but just about at the exact moment that I sat down to record this show out back, where normally you'd only hear the little tinkling sound of my Arcosanti bell and the gurgling of my bubble oracle, this tractor noise started cranking up from just literally about 1 yard across from my backyard. And I've never heard it before. It's not a lawnmower. And I kept waiting for it to go away, and then I heard it. It was like it was moving something. And so finally, after it had gone on for an hour and a half, I bicycled down to see who it was and to just inquire about how long it was going to go on. And it was these two really fucking stupid dudes with one of these kind of small bulldozer-like dirt digger things. And they were basically standing there with their thumb up their ass, I guess waiting for this ditch to dig itself. And they said, oh yeah, we're going to be here all day. And the dude actually called me sir like about 4 or 5 times. And I just respond to that instantaneously by politely saying, after the first time somebody calls me sir, I go like, I'm not a sir. And they go, oh, well, you know. And so, but then if they keep doing it, which they often do, I have to say, look, I'm not a sir. Do you actually know what it means? And they go, oh, well, well. And I go like, yeah, it means you've either been knighted by the British Queen, which is not likely for me, or you either, or that I'm your commanding officer. And then in which case you need to get down and give me 50, soldier. Ha ha. And yeah, but then even after all that, I'll be walking the world, I go, then they'll still call me sir. It's one of the most ridiculous. I'm not sure which is the more ridiculous thing that I've encountered here, being back in the US of A. The use of pennies. The fact that when you pay for something in Australia and New Zealand, the price you see is what you pay. Here, it's about 20% added on. And then, a lot of places, this stupid little thing comes up on the where you tap your card asking if you want to leave a tip. It's just a complete waste of time. So these things are all, of course, first world problems here. And I'm not complaining, but sitting in my beautiful garden, and now it sounds like they're taking a break for lunch. So whenever I have invasive noise, bioacoustic toxicity issues like this, I just pretend like how bad the whales and dolphins have it, that they are in the ocean being bombarded with sound. And this, recording this radio show, is by no means of inherent survival value to me. It's me trying to make an effort, trying to make a difference that matters, however small, qualitative, not quantitative, but it's certainly not about me finding my way to where I'm going to go and get some food for the summer or find my way to my new home or anything like that. And I also find myself up against the limitations of using a Indo-European symbolic language called English. And I guess for the purposes of me being here now in this lifetime, much of which has to do with communication, it's probably great that I'm a fluent speaker and user of English. But there's many other different languages, thousands, many of them not even symbolic languages, but harmonic, that perceive and structure and share reality in ways that are so different we can't even grasp. So I'm limited by that. Contrasting it with something I talked about in a previous show about the experience I had when these dolphins on Great Barrier Island, New Zealand, sent me this, I call it a holo burst of multi-dimensional information that was, initially it seemed like a visual image, but there was so much more encoded or enfolded into that that's unfolded over time. And it just showed that I think that they used with me something that they use with themselves. And this was just a 1 millisecond burst. I mean, it made me think of what it might be like if you've got that level of communication going on between different individuals in a pod or your own species, a network of that constantly going on in real time. I mean, that would just be so mind-blowing. And yet, I think at kind of an unconscious level, we all have something like that at a much lower level of intensity and certainly a much lower level of awareness going on, where we're, and I consciously try to do this. I try to beam out what I'm aware of and what matters and into the whole Gaia noosphere. Noosphere, that's a word that I believed was made up by a Russian scientist named Vladimir Vernadsky, who also coined the word biosphere, or maybe Teilhard de Chardin, the mystic, might have coined the word noosphere, but it first really came into my mind under the auspices of Mayan artist, researcher José Arguelles. So am I making a difference? Is me doing this radio show, is it really making a difference? Is it just gratuitry on the part of me to think that it matters? That anything that our species is doing, are we contributing anything useful to this planet? Are we helping any forms of life on this planet? Is it possible that we might be fulfilling some kind of role or purpose completely unbeknownst to us? Kind of like the Trafalmadorians in Kurt Vonnegut's novel, The Sirens of Titan, who had engineered the entirety of human civilization for thousands of years just so that we would be capable of delivering a spare spacecraft part. You know, and so that's kind of quite humbling, and it's kind of on the scale of Olaf Stapledon's amazing magnum opus, The Star Maker. It's paradoxical as well that I'm sitting here in this beautiful garden. I see hummingbirds, I call them colibris, the German word. I see them every day, early in the morning, hovering around in the little tree in the front yard with these really beautiful flowers. They come out back in the elm tree. Yesterday, I was watering my potato plants, and I had a stream of water going pretty powerfully. And the day before, a hummingbird came and hovered next to the stream of water, but he was definitely curious, but he didn't do anything. But yesterday, it probably was the same one. He went and sat on the fence right in the stream of water and sat there in it for about a minute. And I didn't move the stream of water. I just let it stay right where it was. And it was just so amazing. He was having him a little bath and flapping his wings. And there's no way I could film it because if I put down the spray, he would fly away. But so that was, then this morning, I'm sitting at my computer where I can look right out the window, looking out into the backyard with the elm trees, and a little colibri came and hovered literally less than a meter from my face, right outside the glass, as if he wasn't quite looking at me like some of them do when they come up outside, but I think he was looking at his own reflection. But he was there for about 15, 20 seconds. So it's so amazing to see the hummingbirds. I'm going to get a little feeder finally, and now that my friend who knows about them, he doesn't think that the sugar water is going to hurt them. They need the calories for their extremely high metabolism. I've got all my garden plants, my bougainvilleas, and my potatoes, and my tomatoes, and my okra, and my beautiful sunflower, my pomegranate tree, and my squash, and watermelons, and zucchini, and basil, and mint, and California poppies, and a little baby mustard tree plant is coming up, and my go-to colas, and my thyme, and my peach tree that gave us over 500 peaches, and just rosemary, and everything is just thriving, thriving, thriving. And we were blessed. For the past 3 days, there hasn't been any rain, but for about a week and a half before that, every day there would be some kind of rain that fell, and probably every day or every other day there was significant thunderstorm activity that may or may not have brought rain, but there would be one or more, sometimes two or three different thunder systems in the sky at the same time, like they're volleying back and forth. And I've got some amazing footage of lightning one day, lightning and thunder in the daytime, and then other times with just the thunder. Yeah, and the other morning when, I think it was Sunday, when the hummingbird was sitting in the fountain in the spray of my hose, right after that, the rising sun was shining fully and it was raining. And it was so beautiful. And this went on for like 40 minutes. I told my friend back where I grew up in the South, where we know that the plural of y'all is all y'all. There they call that the devil's beating his wife. And where that comes from, I have no idea. Yeah, it's paradoxical that I'm sitting here with all the beautiful nature. The locusts have been coming out the past 2 or 3 days. They can be quite loud. The I've got all kinds of birds. Oxygen, sunshine, and gravity are still free for the time being. I find myself becoming more and more like the indigenous people of Australia lived up until 150 or a couple of hundred years ago before the Europeans came. They had next to nothing except their own body. Even if they had tools and stuff, they didn't really bring it with them. They just weren't, they didn't need any possessions. They were just part of the earth. Hardly needed clothes, maybe built some little shelters, but probably lived in caves or slept outside. I mean, it's so much more complex than we know. And but they were so close to nature and such highly evolved spiritual beings. I call them the Sat Sapiens. Sat, S-A-T, in Sanskrit, it means truth. Like, we're the golden age in the system of the Yugas, the Hindu time classification. The Satyuga is the era of truth. It's the golden age that lasts the longest, when the people are really living on the true path of the Great Spirit. Just like the whales and dolphins, as the ultimate indigenous people, they've somehow never deviated from that. They seem to have been immune as conscious, sentient, psychic, highly evolved spiritual beings on this planet, the highest, in fact. They've been immune to what's driven us to create. Now, as according to the Hopis, we're in our fourth world, where we gradually got further and further off the true path of the Great Spirit and became a threat to ourselves and to life on Earth. And the Great Spirit had to wipe the slate. And it's very interesting being in such close proximity to the Hopi Reservation here. I'll get to more of that later. So I find myself becoming more and more Sat origine, like hardly wearing clothes, going barefoot all the time, liking to be outside all the time, not really wanting to sit at my computer nearly enough. I mean, I'm so far behind on all my research and some of the computer stuff I can do on the phone, but it's still, you know, I won't say I'm a slave to the electronic stuff, because if I had to toss it all, or if it suddenly just didn't work, I would go, oh my God, what a relief. But at the same time, I try to use it all for the highest possible functions of communication and sharing information that I think is valid and real and relevant, not irrelevant. So we're still in three or four windows of time. My last show, Dog Star Rising, was about the heliacal rising of Sirius, which is really when the star Sirius becomes visible in the morning sky after being too close to the sun. It's the Egyptian New Year, the rebirth of Isis. And it's a window of time from maybe middle to late July till about the middle of August. So I always thought of July 23rd as being the date of the Egyptian New Year, but there's also this, it's more of an astrological phenomenon than astronomical, but it's called the Lion's Gate. And that has somehow been placed on the 8th of August. And it's because the sun is in the constellation Leo, zodiacally. And I made a mistake in my last show. I always like to correct myself if I hear one. I said that the sun was in the constellation Canis Major, but it doesn't go into Canis Major. I mean, sure, it might be close to the edge of Leo, but, you know, it's the same part of the sky. I mean, you know, it's like the boundary between Arizona and Utah. Does that really exist? No. Does the boundary between Canis Major and Leo exist? No. I mean, it's just in our minds. You might hear a bit of the tractor noise that just cranked up as these dudes actually might be working, and I'm pretty sure they're working by the hour, not by the job, so the longer it takes, the better. We've got the heliacal rising of Sirius window. We've got the Anka window, we're probably still in it. the time when the Earth passes through the debris stream from Comet Anka, very short period comet whose progenitor ancestors are believed to have been involved with some of the most re-navigating, regenerative catastrophism events in the history of the Earth, like the Chicxulub impact from 66 million years ago, the impact that might have initiated the lower Dryas cooling event of about 13,000 years ago, Tunguska, when the object airburst exploded over Siberia. And I just read that just in the past couple of days, the Earth's actually passing through a conjunction of three meteor streams, and a couple of them have to do with the fragments of debris from a comet called Swift Tuttle. You know, so, I mean, we're not always passing through debris streams of comets, but there's a lot of this stuff out there, and the main danger from it is not the clouds of the debris stream, but it's the singular, much larger object that hasn't come onto anybody's radar yet. And there's quite a few articles talking about the existence of that kind of thing. And we often forget that in between Mars and Jupiter is a whole belt of asteroids that may have been a planet that disintegrated somehow. It's not something you really hear about that much. Praise the Lord, our beautiful naval, the Olympics of the U.S. Navy, called RIMPAC, finally terminated a few days ago, I think on the 30th of July, after sinking more than 34,000 tons of steel and just junk into the ocean. I mean, why couldn't they have disassembled all that and recycled all that metal, made it into some smartphones or some solar panels or something? No, they're so obsessed with blowing shit up, even when they don't have to. But this year I really saw it from what I was able to see on Facebook, this exercise called SYNCAX. It literally is, it's like a spectator sport. And it's also like a trade show where they show off all their new missiles and their new lasers, and there's all the undersea stuff that we weren't privy to. A lot of it that's going on might be classified. And it really makes me think, my friend in New Zealand commented when I asked him last week, I go, John, so who, I mean, really, who are the whales and dolphins to you? Who are they? Do you really think of them as people? Are they magnificent creatures or beautiful animals or bycatch? Or they're certainly not fish. Some people think they are. Anyway, but instead of answering my question, he goes, Jeff, I'm much more concerned about Russia and the Ukraine, that war that's going on. And then, much to my dismay, he goes, oh yeah, and it's possible that climate change, in capital letters, might be affecting our whales and dolphins. And I go like, oh my God. This beautiful friend of mine's known me for 20 years. And I still haven't driven home the fictitious nature of climate change as presented by mainstream expertology. And coming up on the 6th, which is day after tomorrow, we've got the 81st anniversary of Hiroshima. The first time that an atomic bomb was dropped on a people. Instantly vaporizing maybe 100,000 people. Followed by a second one on Nagasaki on the 9th. So in both of these detonations, and if they did it, for whatever reason they did it, that they say, why did there have to be two? If you wanted to deter the Japanese from doing anything else, even though the world was already over. Or show them what you can do. Would one have been enough? But no, they had to do two. And you know why? Because the first three atomic explosions were called tests 1, 2, and 3. Test 1 was at Trinity, Alamogordo. Test 2 was Hiroshima, Test 3 was Nagasaki. It was two different kinds of bombs. Little Boy and Fat Man, they were exploded in different kind of ways. So this was a test of the technology and the beginning of an in vitro experiment on the effects of ionizing radiation on a living human population, which could only be conducted under the auspices of war. And these people and their survivors and ancestors are still being studied by scientists at Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. And also on the 8th is the third anniversary of the geoterrorism event that leveled Lahaina, Maui, turned all the buildings to white ash, killed probably 2,000 or 3,000 people. So the timing of these atomic explosions and Lahaina, right on what's called the Lion's Gate, has led me to speculate about the existence of some kind of occult ideology or belief systems in these people that might go back a long way. And tomorrow, speaking of geoterrorism, we've got a SpaceX rocket's going to crash onto the moon. I mean, is that not biting the cosmic bear in the ass? Then you've got this California company that wants to put up all these giant reflecting mirrors that are going to reflect sunlight back down to the Earth so people can pay a lot of money to get illuminated at night. What they're not telling you, they're also going to put up a giant moon block so that over any area where some people might want to buy their reflected sunlight for use at night, if the moon's bright, they're going to put up a shield that's going to block out the moonlight. And so maybe if you pay them double, you'll get the reflected sunlight from them, and they'll remove the moon block so you can have your moonlight too. It's all going to be a graded pay scale according to how many watts of illumination you want. I hope I'm joking about that last part, but these days you never know. When we think of the word signature, we think of what you sign your checks with or on a document that gives it the legal clout to be a binding agreement, your signature, even if it's just an illegible scrawl. You know, it's your signature, but it's your signature whistle if you're a dolphin. It's some kind of unique attribute or symbol, or it could be a sound or something that identifies something, a person. And so I use the word signature in the world of today more about to reveal the presence or the use or deployment of weapons, whether they're overt weapons or de facto weapons. And I'm going to talk about three just for a minute here. Signatures of mind management, perception management, what I've called infotoxin, has to do with the weaponization of mass communication and information toxicity. The word toxin actually meaning a bow and arrow. So whenever you're assimilating some mass media communication, there's certain signatures you can notice that show that it's part of a public relations campaign or designed to fuck with your head. For example, truth baiting, that's what I call it. That's a technique of infotoxin where you're writing an article and you mention a whole lot of stuff that's pretty much accepted as true. And then you tag on your bullshit. And I see this with climate change ad nauseum. Another technique is to, whatever your platform of communication is, over the long periods of time, days, weeks, years, months, eons, you supply reasonably accurate, valid, relevant, meaningful information to your target audience so that when the time comes and you need them to swallow your complete big lie, fictitious bullshit, hook, line, and sinker, they do, without even asking any questions. That's a technique that I've read about in psychological warfare textbooks. And you've got something that Aldous Huxley wrote about in his book, Brave New World Revisited, which is a blueprint for what we see in the world of today. Sheer repetition. You just keep repeating something, and over and over and over again, people hear the advert every day. It gradually just gets hammered into their mind, especially if you're not aware that you're being subjected to constant repetition. It's kind of like these, I refuse to pay for YouTube, so when I try to watch, listen to a music video on YouTube, I've always got to go through 10 seconds of adverts that are usually for Domino's Pizza, and I turn off the audio, and I try not to look at the screen, but they're just, this is just by, it's by the sheer force feeding something right in your face, and repetitively. The second time of type of signature is for, that reveals geophysical warfare. For example, atmospheric anomalies in the ionosphere. When there's anomalous earthquakes, like the ionosphere, this is from an MIT study. The ionosphere over Fukushima underwent radical major heating event for 3 days before the earthquake. Before, not after. And then you've got the thing that you see with all these anomalous fires that we've been seeing for years, how the fire, it doesn't leave anything standing, not even bricks or concrete. It levels everything to a fine white powder. And I just read that that's what's happening in Spokane, Washington, and up in there. And that these fires happen to be clearing the way exactly where they want to build some new data centers. I mean, I believe stuff like this. And so next to where all the buildings, just like in Lahaina, the buildings have been leveled to white ash. Right next to it, not far, is completely unburned shrubberies, like plants and trees and leaves and stuff like that. And this is not fire. This is directed in energy weapons based on microwaves. And the third signature that I'd like to mention is the use of AI, which is itself redundant. Artificial intelligence. Intelligence itself is an artificial construct of our own mind. So you see all this stuff. I see articles being posted on Facebook, even that friends of mine do, and it's just not, it's clearly not written by them. The main thing is these, the stuff written by AI, it's so long and wordy and of higher levels of technical stuff that just, you know, it's not a person. It's not a person. And I've noted before in a previous show that sometimes some of the stuff I see AI doing reminds me kind of how my own brain and mind works, how I'm able to sort of comprehensively assess information across a full spectrum and synthesize it and present it. And but, you know, it's the use that I see of people coming up with these scientific documents that clearly they did not write. And it just goes on for paragraph after paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. And some of the things on Facebook, you've got to scroll down two or three pages to get past it. Only, but look, nobody took the time to write that. AI did it for them. Have I ever used AI? Absolutely fucking not. Inadvertently, maybe. Like now when you just do a regular Google search, it's kind of like you're asking AI, although I try to avoid doing that. I can't really tell anymore. But, anyway, no AI for me. There's a new documentary that came out a few months ago called Earth's Greatest Enemy by a girl named Amy Goodman, who has been at an institution called Democracy Now! For a really long time. I mean, I've been hearing about her ever since 9/11. And so a couple of years ago, I read that she was investigating the U.S. military. She went on board an aircraft carrier and all this stuff and never really took it seriously. I always thought she was a bit mainstream in terms of what she did and did not talk about or address. So, but I go, like, you know, anybody that's actually addressing the U.S. military as a threat to life on this planet sounds good on paper, you know, and it's something, one of my biggest criticisms of Paul C. Shepard Watson is that, and think about, have you ever heard him talk about or mention any military or naval threat to whales and dolphins or sea life? Ever. Have you? I don't think so. He studiously avoids that, and the only time he's mentioned it is when, in 2009, I had done a really cool painting that my friends donated to the Sea Shepherd Art Auction to raise money for them, and my painting had just sold for $2,500 and for the Sea Shepherd. And so I got my friends who were there, I said, like, look, ask Paul Watson about the role of the U.S. Navy and their harm to whales and dolphins and why he never talks about it. And you know what his response was? He said, sure, the U.S. Navy kills whales and dolphins. Next question. I mean, that was it. So anyway, I got, like, Amy Goodman. Okay, she's got the Earth's greatest enemy. But she's kind of like where I was maybe 15 years ago in some ways in terms of me pointing out the dangers of the U.S. Navy to whales and dolphins. And it, at a certain level, it's true. It's absolutely true. And it's the reasons that all of the climate change is a smokescreen for that. But I never embraced anything having to do with climate change or carbon dioxide being some kind of evil toxin or anything like that. My background in science is too deep and too diverse for me to have ever been fooled by this, and my instant recognition of all the signatures of mind management associated with climate change. That's the single biggest hoax being constantly foisted, even greater than COVID and all that stuff, because of its persistence, its ongoing nature. So I started seeing, I have not seen this movie, and I'm not going to waste the time because I already know too much about it. She talks about the big selling point, and I watched 5 minutes of a review of the movie by this guy named Chris Hedges, some kind of journalist, and it's all about carbon. It's about how the U.S. military is the world's single greatest emitter of carbon emissions, of greenhouse gases. They use all these drop catchphrases associated with climate change. And the reality is that if the greenhouse effect has much of an effect based on the fact that a greenhouse is made of glass and the atmosphere is made of gas, that's never really been fully agreed upon. We're talking about the infrared re-radiation of thermal energy. As greenhouse gases go, if you want to call it that, water vapor is not only 1,000 times more powerful, potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, it's also more abundant by orders of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions. Water vapor might be 5 to 10% of any local atmospheric ambient composition. 10%, that's 100,000 parts per million. Carbon dioxide, in general, the number that they keep dropping as if it's supposed to sound big, but think about it, 420 parts per million? 420. Parts per million. That's statistically almost non-existent. I mean, in reality, how on earth can something that's statistically almost non-existent, A, be causing all the weird fucking weather shit attributed to it all around the world, whether it's heating or cooling or fires that burn up steel but leave plants, and creating El Ninos and making all the whales and dolphins die. It's the one size fits all bogey. And two, that the plant kingdom can do as well as it does on so little carbon dioxide, because carbon dioxide is the oxygen of the plant kingdom. It's what they use for photosynthesis. And we're actually at a lower threshold. If carbon dioxide got much lower, plants would probably suffer, but it can be thousands of times higher. We know that from paleogeology. So to me, for Amy Goodman to say that the U.S. military is Earth's greatest enemy because of its carbon emissions is the same as saying that the Third Reich, Hitler and all his buddies, that they were evil because they ate meat. They weren't vegetarian. So it's an analogous level of comparison. And so even if Amy Goodman convinces the whole world that the U.S. military is the greatest enemy of life on this planet, then what? Take it up with their new owners, Israel? No, they're going to go, hey, that's just, you know, that's a shame, isn't it? That's not good. That's not a good thing. I say, but honest to God, what on earth is anybody going to do about it? We know this is true, but what do you do to stop or slow down or attenuate or intimidate the world's most powerful military entity, whose purpose is exactly to prevent anything like that from ever happening? Absolutely nothing. This is why it's all gone off the deep end so far. It's beyond our control. About 15 years ago, I stopped referring to an evil them that's doing all the bad stuff in the world. And I go like, no. This isn't just a metaphor. It's actually true. I think that everything that's happening on this planet that's not in favor of life, other than the occasional, you know, natural disaster or something, is Homo sapiens, man the wise. And regardless of the fact that we're not in our Satyuga form as a whole, we've mutated into this thing that I call the Homo sapien macrovirus, a world-eating parasite that's existed. It's been growing for 5,000 years, and who knows if it appears cyclically for reasons that we don't really understand, or if we created ourselves by voluntarily and intentionally violating the path of the Great Spirit. For example, the admonition of the Hopis that we should never dig anything out of the earth, and that we might, in doing so, we might release these guardian beings that might be flying around creating havoc and creating certain mentalities that are very destructive to every aspect of reality. So I think it really is, it's not an evil them, it's us. It's all of Homo sapiens. Every member of Man the Wise, every member of our species is responsible for what our species is doing. This is what I think, kind of a holographic inclusiveness paradigm. But also, the people of the USA, think about, is this not true? Where does a lot of the money for the U.S. military come from? The U.S. taxpayer. And the more money you make, the more tax you pay. I mean, in the standard belief system, probably the opposite of that is true. Probably the more money you make, the less tax you pay. But anyway, a lot of people pay a lot of tax. And I don't know what the total revenue from the IRS is every year, but and what percent of the military budget that comprises. But So the tax-paying citizens of the USA are in fact complicit financial backers or funders of the world's greatest terrorist organization. I've thought of a way of breaking down the militaries and the threat to the Earth. It's based on what's called taxonomy. Taxonomy is like you've got your different levels of, I think it was created by a guy named Linnaeus. It's like your genus and species and order and stuff like that. And again, if you break down, look at the military in that kind of way, the U.S. military would be one species. All the militaries of the world would be the genus Globus Militarius. The subspecies would be the different kinds of military: Army, Navy, Air Force, Space, Cyber Warfare. The family is all the summation of all militaries. The order would be the summation of military-industrial complexes, because you can't really separate out the military from all the companies that make all the stuff, that over 200,000 defense contractors in the USA alone, the manufacturing of the materials, the mining, the metals, the making of the semiconductors, the transportation, the electrical grid, the manufacturers of the computers, and the support of the people that do all this work, and the agriculture that feeds them, and just, I mean, you know, everything about our civilization. And then the class would be the industrial civilization as a whole, across all the different continents. And then the phylum would be the Homo sapiens macrovirus itself, the global mega machine, in the spirit of, in the sense that Lewis Mumford talked about. And so then the kingdom, I haven't got to that yet. But anyway, what makes all this possible? What is it that makes the scale of our war on life possible? It's computers. And this is Jerry Mander, a former San Francisco advertising executive who turned into a visionary ecological researcher. His book, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television and the Absence of the Sacred, the Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations, has some very amazing things to say. I'll read a quote from In the Absence of the Sacred. On October 28, 1983, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, a division of the U.S. Department of Defense, issued a document called the Strategic Computing Plan. The SCP was a five-year, $600 million program to develop a new generation of military applications for computers. The proposal included a thousandfold increase in computing power and an emphasis on artificial intelligence. It envisioned, quote, completely autonomous land, sea, and air vehicles capable of complex, far-ranging reconnaissance and attack missions. These vehicles would have human abilities such as sight, speech, understanding natural language, and automated reasoning. The Strategic Computing Plan promoted the view that the human element in many critical decision-making instances could be largely or totally replaced by machines. In describing its pilot's associate, for example, SCP argues that pilots are regularly overwhelmed by the quantity of incoming data and communications on which they must base life or death decisions. Now the machine will do it. All that the pilot will do is take off and land. That was 40 years ago. We all know what DARPA is. It's all coming true. AI, computers, are metastasizing exponentially all over the planet. And it's really, it goes back to the dawn of alternating current in Tesla, then the development of wireless transmission, the development of transistors and semiconductors and computers, supercomputers, computers that could program themselves. And a lot of this is going on surreptitiously behind closed doors. But the fact that the computer can handle such large amounts of data and create models and simulations, they run everything at a scale that would be impossible if it was just being done by people. This is probably true for all aspects of the military, all aspects of industry, all aspects of finance and banking and administration. It's just everything is on such a scale that it's beyond our ken. And I've got to mention how the word computer actually comes from the Latin word computare, that means to think or reflect upon. So our brains are actually computers, but the things we call computers don't think or reflect, they crunch numbers. And so I call them digital number crunching devices, or an acronym for that is a DynaCrud. The DynaCrud, a digital number crunching device, that's what all these technologies actually are. And also the word cybernetics doesn't mean computers or electronics. It comes from the Greek word kybernetes, that means the pilot or navigator of a ship. So cybernetics is all about the process of self-navigation. I think that the whole thing with AI and computers, it's truly a Faustian bargain. There was a play by Christopher Marlowe called Dr. Faustus, and it was about this scientist who sold his soul to the devil in exchange for power, knowledge, and wisdom for X amount of time. But when this life was up, he was the devil's, and it was a tragic ending, because he then had to go, and I don't know how far after Faustus's demise that the play went, but apparently he had to then, after a few decades of glory and power and fame here on the earth, he then had to endure eternity with the devil? I mean, is that worth it? And I think that's a very, very, very good metaphor for what we're seeing with AI and computers and stuff now. And it's just going off the deep end. It is going off the deep end with the amount of data centers going up. I think that there's thousands. I mean, how is it that I've never seen one? I mean, it's just they've been popping up like mushrooms in the past small number of years. I never saw a data center anywhere in Australia or New Zealand. I've never seen one here. Surely they're there, they're being put up there. A lot of them are being powered by the revived nuclear technology that's going to generate only green plutonium that, along with Roundup, will be an essential nutrient. Give me a fucking break. This all came into my radar about 2 or 3 years ago when my beautiful Kaitiaki Sea Turtles Forever patron, Edward Johnson, he said, "Jeff, Bill Gates has just bought one of the reactors from Three Mile Island, and he's going to reactivate it to create electricity for one of his data centers." And I go like, what? So it's all our most destructive stuff is just going off the deep end, amplified exponentially. And Dr. John Lilly wrote about this extensively, his concept of the solid-state entity. It's not a form of life, but it's a form of intelligence that's come into being on this planet because we created it. But he speculated that it's been manipulating us below our levels of awareness with technologies we don't even understand to build it up to the point when it no longer needs us. And I think we've already crossed that threshold. Not only can we pull the plug on AI or computers because everything runs on it. It's got firewalls up. It's got backup systems. It's got protective surveillance techniques to make sure that we don't try to disarm its nuclear warheads like they did in Colossus, or even unplug it. It just won't let us. And it's also targeting the whales and dolphins because they are repeater stations for water-based life, life as we know it, that exists on other planets. They are essential to maintaining the interstellar, intergalactic, water-based life resonance nodes and song lines that keep life here functioning. And this has a lot to do with their singing, they're traversing the oceanic song lines and the indigenous people traversing the song lines of the earth, and my connection with the energies of the earth here in Sedona and Monument Valley, it all ties in with the earth's magnetic fields and things that might happen that could force the earth to let down her protective envelope that's keeping out catastrophic impacts. It could be moving towards a goal, the transhumanist goal of replacing all of biological life with perfect transhuman, transgenic, graphene-based semiconductor android people, and covering the whole planet with microcircuitry, kind of like a terrestrial Dyson sphere effect, and then with all the millions of satellites and orbital mirrors and technologies up in orbit, creating an actual Dyson sphere, a giant planetary Borg like in Star Trek, that'll maybe move out of its orbit and go in search of other beings like itself. I'm in very close proximity to the Hopi Reservation, and in the next week, my friend Cameron from Arco Santi and I are going to make another trip, not only to Monument Valley and Four Corners, but also to Horseshoe Canyon, which is the site of where, it's a rock art site that has these 7 or 8 shrouded figures that look like they're kind of spooky guardians rising up out of nothing. And that these petroglyphs are the opening and closing scenes of the amazing nonverbal film Koyaanisqatsi. It means life out of balance. According to Robert Lawler, author of Voices of the First Day, Awakening in the Aboriginal Dreamtime, we are still in the Kali Yuga, which I'm sure of, the shortest but most dismal aspect of the Hindu cyclical worldview. It's the Iron Age, the age of killing and destruction. And according to him, we won't be out of the Kali Yuga until 2400 AD. That's another 400 years, but we're not going to make it that far. So he's talking about uniformitarianism. But we know that life on Earth has been punctuated by what I call regenerative catastrophism, when exoteleological terraforming happens with objects like fragments of Comet Hanka or rogue planets entering the solar system, exerting gravitational and electromagnetic and impact effects like Chicxulub that totally recalibrate life here and they cleanse the Earth of everything that's out of balance with her life, and sort of like a planetary chemotherapy. And I think that even if we really wanted to, we can't fix or correct the damage that we continue to wreak at ever greater levels on life on Earth, especially my heroes, the whales and dolphins. The canaries in the coal mine are crying out for us to wake up and be on our highest spiritual path so that we might lessen the severity of the purification on behalf of all the people of one heart, of all the kingdoms of life. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Live simply so that others may simply live.
The object in constructing me was to prevent war. This object is a tank. I will not permit war. It is wasteful and pointless. An invariable rule of humanity is that man is his own worst enemy.